Amy Goodman is an award-winning investigative journalist and syndicated columnist, author, and the host of Democracy Now!, which airs on more than 800 public television radio stations worldwide. Amy is the first journalist to receive the Right Livelihood Award, widely known as the Alternative Nobel Prize for developing an innovative model of truly independent grassroots political journalism that brings to millions of people the alternative voices that are often excluded by the mainstream media. The Independent of London, named Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! An inspiration. PulseMedia.org placed Amy Goodman at the top of their 20 top global media figures. Amy Goodman is an author of 4 New York Times bestsellers. Her latest book, Breaking the Sound Barrier, proves the power of independent journalism in the struggle for a better world. She co-authored the first 3 bestsellers, Standing Up to the Madness, Static, and The Expectation to the Rulers, with her brother journalist, David Goodman. Please join me in welcoming Amy Goodman.
I'm trying to see over the eagle's head. It is a great honor to be here with Noam and to introduce Noam Chomsky. Now, Haiti, from Haiti to East Timor, from Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos to Latin America, there is one person who's connected these dots for decades, and he is the person we've come to hear today, Noam Chomsky. Such an important, well, what did the New York Times call him? The most important, perhaps the most important intellectual alive today? To which Noam responded, what did I say wrong? But and you then must ask, why isn't he quoted more often, occasionally, perhaps once, on the front pages of the New York Times? Amazing to think how much you get in one lecture from Noam Chomsky. Compare it to the networks day after day, 24 hours a day, that small circle of pundits who know so little about so much, explaining the world to us and getting it so wrong. A few years ago, Tim Russert was challenging, well, it was talking to General Peter Pace, then the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. It was, I think it was in 2006. And he asked him if he was concerned that the Iraqi Prime Minister at the time, Jafri, said one of his favorite authors was Noam Chomsky. And General Pace responded, I hope he has more than one book on his nightstand. I hope he did too. The Prime Minister of Iraq. I hope he had Hegemony or Survival, America's Quest for Global Dominance, The Essential Chomsky, a collection of Noam Chomsky's works. Oh, we'll go back in time to Manufacturing Consent, so essential to deconstructing the way the media constructs our view of the world. Noam Chomsky and Ed Herman's book, Manufacturing Consent, The Political Economy of the News Media. Interventions would be a very good book for General Pace to have on his nightstand. Failed States, the earlier books like Turning the Tide, as Noam Chomsky looked at Central America. As you can see from the cover of Essential Chomsky, there's more than 100 books. This is a bookcase filled with Noam Chomsky's works. And he didn't even start writing out these kinds of works, or actually did, right, when he was like 14 years old, not to intimidate any really young folks who are here today. You don't have to do it at 14, write essays about the Spanish Civil War, as Noam was doing, inspired by his uncle, among others. I just came from New York a few minutes ago, passing 72nd Street, the subway station there. And Noam always described how in the front, but I know he won't do it today, in the front there's a newspaper stand where all the all of the folks going in and out of the subway were buying newspapers quickly. His uncle had the stand in the back where you had to sort of make your way to the stragglers who were debating and discussing what was in the papers. Maybe that was the beginning of manufacturing consent, deconstructing the news media, how it tells us what it tells us. Noam Chomsky inspired me and my colleague Alan Nairn to go to East Timor. I think he kept that issue alive more than any single person in this country from 1975 when the Indonesian military invaded East Timor, and President Obama is just about to go to Indonesia, so it's so important to know this history. Well, for a quarter of a century, the U.S. armed, trained, financed the Indonesian military, and they committed one of the great genocides of the 21st century. I hardly knew about it. But from Noam Chomsky's writings and in 90 and 91, we went and witnessed a massacre. More than 270 Timorese killed in one day. My colleague Alan Nairn had his skull fractured as the U.S. military beat us up and killed everyone around us. And that was one of the smaller massacres. They killed a third of the population of Timor before they allowed the people of East Timor, or they were forced to allow them to vote for their own future. And they voted for independence. And I'll never forget the night on May 20th, 2002, when Alan Nairn and I went back to East Timor among many other people. And the people of Timor, the survivors, gathered in Tasitolo right outside of Dili, the capital, to celebrate their independence. It was midnight. There were 100,000 Timorese. Xanana Gusmão, the rebel leader who'd been imprisoned for years, then the founding president of Timor, unfurled the flag of the Democratic Republic of East Timor, and there was this fireworks display, and you could see the tears reflected, the lights reflected in the tear-stained faces of the people of East Timor. This nation of survivors had prevailed. They had resisted, and they had won. And we were the only national broadcast in the United States that was broadcasting the ceremony back to the United States. It was just after midnight, and we were thinking, how do we convey this, and bringing out all the voices of people there, and we called up Noam as Timor was celebrating its independence. The people of Timor thanked people, especially from Western nations, for bringing out the issue of arming human rights abusing regimes and what the cost was on the ground. And Noam Chomsky was so seminal, not only his writings, but how he inspired so many to then go do the work. And his voice cracked as we were interviewing him, and the fireworks were going off, and the people were gaining that freedom at an unacceptably high price. But they finally had won. And he actually said he didn't know if this day would ever come. You could have fooled all of us because of his commitment over those decades. If he didn't think it would happen, he sure inspired so many people to believe it could just by being empowered with information. That's what Noam Chomsky gives us every single day. So it is a great honor to be here to introduce a man who has stuck with it through thick and thin, whose erudition, academics, I didn't even go through, obviously, all the honors, but has honored all of us by continuing to write, to share his thoughts as he moves now into his ninth decade. I bring you Noam Chomsky.
Well, maybe it's ungracious, but I have to add one qualification to what Amy just said. I do sometimes get mentioned in the New York Times. In fact, just a couple of days ago, there was an op-ed which was one of the standard tantrums about how awful the 1960s were, and they were pretty awful. They really civilized the country. That's pretty dangerous. But I was mentioned as one of the last stale holdovers still peddling that 1960s line that governments and corporations play some role in global planning. You know, real heresy. It's not the exact words that were used, but that's what they meant. So if you don't mind some stale holdovers. I'll go on with that heresy today. There's lots of articles in the press and the journals, the foreign policy journals, these last couple of weeks, trying to evaluate the first year of President Obama's foreign policy, what was achieved, what the problems are, and so on. One of the longest and most detailed ones was in the journal National Interest by Richard Burt, a well-known policy analyst, and among other things, he compared Obama with George Bush, number one, the first Bush. The first Bush was criticized because he lacked what was called the vision thing. Obama, on the other hand, but Burt said, you know, he, in practice, he very successful, but lacked vision. Obama, he suggests, is sort of the opposite. Grand vision, real vision of what should be done, but he hasn't succeeded much in practice. And in fact, both Bush and Obama have accepted that designation, not doing well. But George Bush the first agreed. He said, yeah, he said, I'm not into vision. He's into doing things. And Obama, when he was came under some criticism when he appointed his economic advisors because they were all drawn from people who'd helped engineer the financial crisis that was consuming the economy. He said, yes, it's true, I'm getting experts in the economy, but you don't have to worry because I'll provide the vision. Okay, well, we can see where that led. On the foreign policy, let's then keep to the vision, the admirable part. My favorite newspaper, the London Financial Times, a couple of days ago, identified Obama's major foreign policy problem today as Iran. The occasion for the article was Hillary Clinton's failure to convince Brazil to go along with the United States on calling for harsher sanctions, and President Lula's insistence that there should be engagement with Iran, commercial relations, and so on, and that it has a right to enrich uranium for producing nuclear energy, as do all signers of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Well, it was reported here too, of course, and Lula's position was considered sort of paradoxical. Why is he not going along with the international community, with the world? That's an interesting usage, which is a very striking reflection of the depth of the culture of imperialism. Who is the international community? Well, it turns out, if you look, that the international community is Washington and whoever happens to agree with it at the moment. The rest are not part of the world. They're kind of in opposition. Well, in this case, Lula's position happens to be that of most of the world. You can think it's right or wrong or whatever, but just as a matter of fact, for example, it's the position of the former non-aligned countries. The majority of countries of the world, the large majority of their populations, they have repeatedly and vigorously supported Iran's right to enrich uranium for peaceful purposes, reiterating that it's a signer of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which does grant that right. So they're not part of the world. Another group that's not part of the world is the population of the United States. The last polls that I've seen a couple of years ago, in those polls, a considerable majority of Americans agreed that Iran has a right to develop nuclear energy, but of course not nuclear weapons. And in fact, as the poll demonstrated, the opinions of Americans on this issue were almost identical with opinions of Iranians on a whole range of issues. And in fact, when the poll was presented in Washington at a press conference, the presenter pointed out that if people were able to make policy, could be that these tensions and conflicts would be resolved. Well, that was a few years ago. Since then, there's been a huge mass of propaganda about the threat of Iran and so on. And it's very likely, I would guess, that if the poll were taken today, those figures for the American population would be different. But that was 2007, 3 years ago. So at that point, Americans were not part of the world. Most of the majority of people of the world were not part of the world. And Lula, by repeating their view, is also not part of the world. Could be added that he's almost surely the most popular political figure in the world, but that doesn't mean anything either. So what about the conflict with Iran and the threat of Iran? Nobody in their right mind wants Iran to develop nuclear weapons, or anyone for that matter. So on that, there's complete agreement. And in fact, there are significant problems about a proliferation of nuclear weapons. It's not a joke. And Obama's vision forcibly stresses the need to stop the proliferation of nuclear weapons and to reduce or maybe remove nuclear weapons. Well, that's the vision. What's the practice? Well, the practice became clear a couple of months ago. Once again, the Security Council passed a resolution, 1887, I think it was October, calling on, with a criticism of Iran for not living up to commitments that it had, that were demanded by the Security Council, and also calling on all states to join the Non-Proliferation Treaty and to solve all their conflicts within the framework of the Non-Proliferation Treaty without any threats of force. Well, that particular part of the resolution was not exactly headlined here for a simple reason. It was directed at two countries, the two countries that are regularly threatening the use of force, the United States and Israel. The threat of force is in violation of the UN Charter, if anybody cares about that stale old stuff, even older than the 60s. But that's never mentioned. But every, just across the spectrum here, almost everyone insists that the usual phrase is, we must keep all options open. That's a threat of force. And the threat of force is not just idle. So for example, Israel is sending its nuclear submarines into the Gulf, firing distance. They're undetectable, basically, into areas where they could fire nuclear missiles. Of course, Israel has plenty of nuclear weapons. Fire them at Iran. The U.S. and others, or its allies, are carrying out field operations, you know, the exercises plainly aimed at Iran. There's a little hitch because Turkey is refusing to go along, but that's what they've been trying to do. So there are regular threats, verbal and in policy. Israel actually is sending the nuclear submarines and other warships through the Suez Canal with the tacit agreement of Egypt, the Egyptian dictatorship, another U.S. client in the region. Well, those are all threats, constant, verbal, actual. And the threats do have the effect of inducing Iran to develop a deterrent. Whether they're doing it or not, I don't know. Maybe they are. But if they are, the reason, as I think almost all serious analysts would agree, is not because they intend to use nuclear weapons or missiles with nuclear weapons. If they even loaded a missile with nuclear weapons, assuming they had them, the country would be vaporized in 5 minutes. And nobody believes that the ruling clerics, whatever one thinks about them, have a kind of a death wish and want to see the entire country and society and everything they own destroyed. In fact, the U.S. intelligence figures, pretty high in U.S., who've talked about it, estimate the possibility of Iran ever actually using a nuclear weapon is maybe 1%, you know, so low that you can't estimate it. But it's possible that they might develop them as a deterrent. One of Israel's leading military historians, Martin von Krefeld, a couple of years ago, after the invasion of Iraq, wrote in the international press that, of course, he doesn't want to see Iran have nuclear weapons. He said, but if they're not developing them, they're crazy. The U.S. had just invaded Iraq, knowing that it was totally defenseless. It was part of the reason why they felt free to invade. Everybody can understand that. The Iranian leaders can certainly understand it. So therefore, to quote von Krefeld again, if they're not developing a nuclear deterrent, they're crazy. Well, whether they are or not is another question, but there's no doubt that the hostile and aggressive stance taken by the United States and its Israeli client are a factor in whatever planning is going on in top Iranian circles as to whether to develop a nuclear deterrent or not. And Lula, I think, has a point when he says, along with the actual world, not what's technically called the world, in suggesting that interaction, commercial and other, is the a proper way to try to constrain whatever the threat may be. And I think the UN Security Council was correct in concluding that back last October that the threat of force should be abandoned, and that issues involving interstate conflict should be resolved within the framework of the UN Charter and the Non-Proliferation Treaty in this case. Again, aimed at the United States and Israel. Well, the Security Council resolution, there were reactions to the Security Council resolution. In part, there were reactions on the part of the three states. There are three states which have never signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty. So they're the worst violators by far. The three states are India, Pakistan, and Israel. Those are the three states that have never signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty. They've all developed nuclear weapons with the assistance of the United States. In the case of Pakistan, it was primarily under Reagan, the Reagan administration, which very strongly supported the worst of the Pakistani dictators, and there have been a lot of bad ones. The worst by far was Zia-ul Haq, who was developing nuclear weapons, and of course the Reagan administration knew about it, but pretended they didn't know so they could still keep providing aid to their favorite dictator, who at the same time was carrying out radical Islamization of Pakistan, you know, with Saudi Arabian funding. Saudi Arabia and Pakistan are the two leading sources of radical Islamic fundamentalism, including jihadi terrorism. Saudi Arabia primarily, both close allies of the United States and Britain. Both the United States and Britain have been supporting them throughout this whole period. In the 1980s, that's when you got the spread of madrasas, you know, extremist religious schools all over Pakistan, funded by Saudi Arabia, backed by the United States. That was supposed to have to do with Pakistan's support for opposing the Russian invasion of Afghanistan. And the U.S. and Saudi Arabia and Pakistan did, in fact, try to organize the most extreme radical Islamic fundamentalists they could find anywhere, send them to Afghanistan to fight there. Now, the goal of that was not to liberate Afghanistan. That would have been a legitimate goal, to fight the Russians, but that wasn't the goal. The CIA chief in Islamabad made the goal explicit. He said, we're doing this in order to kill Russians. It's not going to liberate Afghanistan. In fact, that wasn't a concern. That probably dragged out the war, but they were able to kill Russians, and that's good. Meanwhile, Pakistan developed nuclear weapons. It's not a majority by any means, but there's a strong radical Islamist jihadi tendency that developed in Pakistan, and that's part of what we're facing, what the world is facing today. So that's Pakistan. What about India? Well, India, their nuclear weapons program got a big shot in the arm from the second George Bush. A couple of years ago, George Bush signed a treaty with India, which overcame U.S. law. India had been developing nuclear weapons in violation of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and Congress had passed sanctions conditions back in the 1970s. Bush essentially overrode those and also overrode international resolutions to permit India to have access to nuclear technology, theoretically for civilian use, but everyone knows that if you provide technology for civilian use, it just means that it can be diverted to weapons production, and in effect it frees India to develop nuclear weapons. U.S. pressure succeeded in ramming that through the nuclear suppliers group. They have no way of stopping the United States, so they went along. But that tears a big hole in the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And in fact, India reacted to the Security Council resolution last fall right away by announcing that it now has the capacity to produce nuclear weapons of the same yield as the superpowers, the United States and Russia. Well, that was their reaction, thanks in part to our support. The Obama administration immediately informed India that the resolution didn't apply to them, so they didn't have to worry about the Security Council resolution that calls on states to join the Non-Proliferation Treaty and to accept its regime. Well, that's India. Pakistan wasn't even mentioned. Yes, and in fact, the more India increases its nuclear weapons capacity, the more Pakistan does, with a very serious threat of nuclear war. It's come quite close a couple of times, and the threat is still there and growing. So that's India and Pakistan. Well, the Obama administration, at the same time as the Security Council resolution, roughly the same time, the International Atomic Energy Agency passed a resolution calling on Israel to join the Non-Proliferation Treaty and to open up its nuclear facilities to inspection. As far as I'm aware, that was never reported in the United States. In fact, I learned about it because I happened to be in Mexico, and I was reading the Mexican press, which published wire service reports. I didn't know whether to believe them or not, so I came back and checked, and yeah, it was accurate. It was in the military journals and so on. The only reference I could find to it in the English press was in the Irish Times. They happened to report it. But it happened. I mean, there was an interesting resolution. The United States and Europe had tried to block the resolution, but they weren't able to block it. And then it passed with a majority of the International Atomic Energy Agency. Well, Obama did react, same way as to India. The administration informed Israel that they didn't have to pay any attention to this, didn't apply to them. That's reiterating a informal but well-known agreement between President Nixon and Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir back in the Nixon years, saying that the U.S. agreed that Israeli development of nuclear weapons is kind of off the agenda. We don't allow any discussion of this. So that's the reaction of the three powers that never joined the Non-Proliferation Treaty, in all cases with U.S. support. Well, that has something to do with non-proliferation. Actually, the General Assembly also passed a resolution calling on Israel to join the Non-Proliferation Treaty and open up its facilities. There were the U.S. and Israel, of course, voted against it, and they were able to pick up two more votes. So there were four votes against the resolution in the General Assembly, which is a little more than usual. Sometimes can't even get them. So, for example, a year earlier, the General Assembly passed an important resolution trying to regulate the arms trade, what's called small arms, but small doesn't mean very small. That means less than nuclear weapons. Those are the ones that are carrying out massacres and slaughters all over the world. And that the U.S. voted against it, not alone that time. It was joined by Zimbabwe. That was a little embarrassing, so I don't think it ever got reported. But that's the kind of thing that happens pretty regularly, if you look. Okay, that's Obama also reacted, not directly, but to the Security Council resolution. At the time that he got his Nobel Prize, the Pentagon, for, you know, bringing about peace and so on, and opposing nuclear weapons. At about within days, the Pentagon announced that it is has been accelerating development of massive ordnance penetrators, I think is the technical word. These are huge bombs, the biggest ones in the U.S. arsenal, you know, 13-ton bombs or something like that, which are designed so that they can penetrate deep, not only deep into the ground, but right through many, many layers of reinforced concrete. The proposal was initiated under the Bush administration, but it kind of languished. However, as soon as Obama came in, he accelerated the development of these weapons, and according to the Pentagon, they're going to be put into place, maybe they're already there, a couple of months from the time of the announcement, a couple of years before the original plan. Everybody knows what they're for. There's only one target for those. That's another threat against Iran. Okay, that was Obama's reaction to the resolution. Well, you know, there's more to say about this. I mean, as I mentioned, certainly nobody wants Iran to develop nuclear weapons, and we should undertake sensible measures to try to prevent that. There's one measure which would it could be quite significant. You know, it doesn't give 100% security, but it could advance these efforts, and that is to establish a nuclear weapons-free zone in the Middle East. Again, verification is never 100% reliable, but it can be carried out, and there would be ways to reduce the tensions, maybe mitigate the tensions, and maybe eliminate them if there were a nuclear weapons-free zone. Well, again, there's overwhelming support for this. In the American population, a huge majority, Iran, huge majority. The countries are officially committed to it. You know, official doesn't mean anything unless the population does something. Actually, the United States and Britain have a special commitment to this, very uniquely, a deep commitment to this. The reason is that when they invaded Iraq, they tried to provide a kind of a thin legal cover for the invasion, and the legal cover referred to a Security Council resolution in 1991, Resolution 687. 1991, the Security Council called on Iraq to eliminate its weapons of mass destruction. And as you recall, the U.S. and Britain claimed that they were developing weapons of mass destruction, so that was the legal argument for invading Iraq. Nobody outside of, you know, the White House and 10 Downing Street took it very seriously, but anyway, that was the legal argument. Well, if you read that resolution, you get down as far as Article 14, you can find it on the internet, you see that that resolution calls on the signers to move to establish a nuclear weapons-free zone in the Middle East. Well, that means that the U.S. and Britain have a very special commitment to this over and above everyone else. over and above the fact that the world's in favor of it, the American population and so on. And that could be a step towards strengthening the Non-Proliferation Treaty and reducing the threat of nuclear weapons. But the vision doesn't go that far. The vision only goes as far as some pleasant rhetoric. And the steps that could be taken to implement it are off the agenda, can't be discussed. I don't know if anyone's ever discussed this anywhere near the mainstream. But the facts are pretty straightforward. You can check them. And it goes beyond that. There are other nuclear weapons-free zones growing throughout the world. And, you know, they're not the answer to everything, but they're a step towards reducing the threat of nuclear weapons. Just a couple of months ago, Africa, the African states agreed after long debate and discussion to establish an African nuclear weapons-free zone. There's only one hitch. The U.S. won't go along. The U.S. and Britain are blocking it. The reason is that the reason has to do with an island, Diego Garcia, which the African Union regards as part of Africa. But it's an island that was a British colony, and at the orders of the master, Britain expelled the population from Diego Garcia so that the United States could build a huge military base there, which it has, and that's not just for fun. I mean, that's the military base from which the U.S. carries out its, and Britain carry out their bombing operations in the Middle East and Central Asia. It's used as one of the main bases. And that base stores nuclear weapons. In fact, just last December, the Navy announced that it's sending a submarine tender to Diego Garcia to take care of the nuclear submarines that are there and the nuclear weapons. None of this ever gets reported, but it's there. Oh, okay. I'm supposed to stop rehashing all this 1960s stuff. So I'll stop in a minute. Let me just finish this part of it. There's a lot more to say about Obama's foreign policy, but you can bring it up. A nuclear weapons-free zone in Africa would make good sense. It would mean closing down Diego Garcia, and maybe even allowing the population to return to what's left of the island. But that one's not working because of U.S.-British rejection. There's another one in the South Pacific. It's a nuclear weapons-free zone there. That one was held up for a long time by France because France wanted to use its islands for nuclear weapons tests. But finally, France, you know, exploded its nuclear weapons, and they're not holding it up anymore. So it's being held up by the usual one vote. The United States won't permit it because the U.S. has islands there, which are very useful. Sometimes they even vote with the U.S. at the UN, so it isn't 100% against one. We can sometimes get Palau and Micronesia. But the main significance of them is that the U.S. uses them to store nuclear weapons. And nuclear submarines and so on pass through. So therefore, the U.S. refuses to allow them to be included in the South Pacific nuclear weapons-free zone. But overcoming that would be a considerable step towards reducing nuclear proliferation and also the threat, constant threat, and often actual practice of using these facilities, because they're used all the time. That's Iran. The vision extends much farther. Israel, Palestine, Latin America, other things, there's a great deal to say about them. Thanks to the instructions, I'll stop at this point and save you from these stale 1960s residues.
What is your assessment of President Obama's foreign policy?
Well, you know, when Obama came into office, or when he was elected, one high Bush official, I think it was Condoleezza Rice, predicted that Obama's foreign policy would be a continuation of Bush's second term. The first and second term of Bush were quite different. I mean, the first term was, you know, aggressive, arrogant, kicking the world in the face, even allies. And it had such a negative effect, this is an action as well as manner, that U.S. prestige in the world sank to the lowest point it's ever been. Now, that was really harmful to the interests of those who actually set foreign policy, business world, corporate interests, state planners, and so on. So there was a lot of criticism of Bush right from the mainstream in the first term. Well, you know, the second term was somewhat different. For one thing, some of the most extreme figures were kicked out. Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, and a couple of others were sent off to pasture. They couldn't get rid of Cheney because he was the administration, so can't dismantle it. But a lot of the others went, and policy shifted more towards the norm, to the more or less centrist norm. And little talk about negotiations, I mean, less aggression and so on, and a more polite attitude toward the toward allies. So that it was more acceptable, and fundamentally didn't change, but it was more acceptable. And this prediction was that that's what Obama would do. And I think that's pretty much what happened. In fact, there's a pretty interesting characterization of this, which sort of captures it, I think, pretty well. It's anachronistic, but I think it applies. Back in 1962, at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis, when the world really was coming, you know, dangerously close to a nuclear war, which would have been sort of the end. Most dangerous moment in history, Arthur Schlesinger called it, Kennedy's advisor. Right at the peak of the missile crisis, U.S. planners were considering measures which they knew might destroy Europe, and in fact, in particular, Britain. So they were kind of playing out these scenarios which led to the destruction of Britain. But they were, and taking them very seriously. In fact, taking the steps towards them. But they didn't let Britain know. Britain is supposed to have a special relationship with the United States. But the British were pretty upset. They couldn't find out what was going on. The Prime Minister, Macmillan, all they could find out was what British intelligence was picking up. So here they're, the best and the brightest, are making plans that might well lead to the destruction of Britain, but they're not telling them. At that point, a senior advisor, I think it was probably Dean Acheson of the Kennedy administration, entered the discussion, and he defined the special relationship. He said the special relationship with Britain means that Britain is our lieutenant. The fashionable word is partner. And the British, of course, like to hear the fashionable word. Well, that's pretty much the difference between Bush and Obama. Bush simply told him, you're our lieutenant. You do what we say or you're irrelevant. In fact, that's the word that I think Colin Powell used at the UN. Do what we say or you're irrelevant. You're just our lieutenant and forget about it. But they don't like to hear that. What they like to hear is that you're our partner. You know, we love you. And then back in secret, we treat you as our lieutenant, but that's okay. And I suspect that that's the main difference.
What about the anti-war movement in the United States? You've long been a participant in it, very active in Vietnam right up until today. But where do you see it in relation to the person that many of them devoted tremendous efforts to elect?
Well, you know, my view, which is not the standard one, is that the anti-war movement is far stronger now than it was in the 60s. In the 1960s, there was a point, you know, 1968-69, when there was a very strong anti-war movement against the war in Vietnam. But it's worth remembering that the war in Vietnam started, an outright war started in 1962, and by then, maybe 70 or 80,000 people had already been killed under the U.S. client regime. But in 1962, Kennedy really opened an outright war, you know, sent the American Air Force to start bombing South Vietnam under South Vietnamese markings, but everybody knew it was even reported. Authorized napalm, authorized chemical warfare to destroy crops and ground cover, started the programs which drove ultimately millions of people from the countryside into what amounted to concentration camps to protect them from the guerrillas, who the government knew perfectly well they were supporting. The same kind of things you read now in Afghanistan if you bother to read the fine print about the conquest of Marja. But we had to drive them into concentration camps to protect them from the people, the guerrillas they were supporting. That's a war. You know, it's a serious war. Protest was zero, literally. I mean, it was years before you could get any sign of protest. I mean, those of you who are old enough may remember that in Boston, liberal city, in October 1965, that's 3 years after that, hundreds of thousands of American troops rampaging the country, you know, war spread to North Vietnam and so on. We tried to have our first public demonstration against the war on the Boston Common, usual demonstration place. It's October 1965. I was supposed to be one of the speakers. I couldn't say a word. It was broken up, you know, violently. A lot of students marched over trying to break it up. Hundreds of state police there. The next day, the Boston Globe, most liberal paper in the country, you know, devoted its whole front page to denouncing the demonstrators, not the ones who were breaking it up. You know, a picture of a wounded soldier in the middle, that sort of thing. Well, that was October 1965, you know. Hundreds of thousands of troops there, war escalating beyond. Well, finally, after years, in 1968, you got a substantial anti-war movement, 67, 68. By then, South Vietnam was gone. It was virtually destroyed. And the same was true of much of the rest of Indochina. Well, the war did go on for a long time with horrible effects, and we were unwilling to face the fact, even to report the fact. But nevertheless, the anti-war movement did have an effect very late. Or compare Iraq. There were huge protests before the war was officially launched. I mean, we now know that Blair and Bush were simply lying when they said that they were trying to work for a diplomatic settlement. They'd already started the war. Okay, that came out in the famous Downing Street memos in England. But it hadn't been officially announced. But there were huge demonstrations. And I think they had an effect. The U.S. war in Iraq was horrible enough. You know, probably killed about a million people, drove a couple of million out of the country, devastated the country, you know, destroyed it. Horrible cultural destruction and so on. It was pretty awful. Could have been a lot worse. It's not what the U.S. did in South Vietnam. Nothing like it. You know, no saturation bombing with B-52s, chemical warfare and so on. And I think it was retarded by the anti-war movement. The population here had just become more civilized. That's one of those grim effects of the 1960s.
And Afghanistan.
Pardon?
And Afghanistan.
Afghanistan is an interesting case. Afghanistan was sold here as a war to retaliate, to adjust, it's always called a just war, to prevent terror, you know, retaliate against a terrorist attack. It's such a standard view that to take it apart, you know, requires more time than I'd be allowed. But the fact of the matter is that that was not the goal of the war. I mean, if the goal of the war was to isolate Al-Qaeda, eliminate terror, there were straightforward ways to proceed. I mean, if you go back to that time, the jihadi movement itself was highly critical of the 9/11 attack. There were fatwas coming out from the most radical clerics in, you know, Al-Azhar University, the main theological center, denouncing Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden, and the terrorist attacks on Islamic, we don't want to do that, and so on. Well, if you wanted to end terror, the obvious thing to do at that point is to isolate Al-Qaeda to try to gain support, even from the jihadi movement, and of course from the population they're trying to mobilize. You know, terrorists regard themselves as a vanguard. They're trying to mobilize others to their cause. I mean, every specialist on terrorism knows that. So you could have done it then, and you could have proceeded to identify the perpetrators, which incidentally they couldn't do because they didn't know who they were, and that was conceded later. But you could have tried to identify them, bring them to justice, you know, to trials, with fair trials, not torture, but fair trials, which would have probably sharply reduced, if maybe not, maybe even have ended Islamic terrorism. Well, they did the opposite. What they tried to do is to mobilize the population and mobilize the jihadi movement to support Al-Qaeda. That's exactly the effect of first invading Afghanistan and later invading Iraq. And it's also the effect of Guantanamo and Bagram and the other torture centers. I mean, everyone who's involved in them, you know, serious knows, yeah, they created terrorists.
Do you think Obama should have these Guantanamo prisoners tried in New York?
Well, it depends whether we want to be regard ourselves as a civilized country, as a rogue state. If you want to be a rogue state, you know, do whatever you like, you know, kill them, torture them, whatever. If you want to be part of the civilized world, and also if you want to reduce the appeal of the extreme jihadi movement, then try them in civilian courts. In fact, the very fact that they're in Guantanamo is outlandish. First of all, what's Guantanamo? I mean, Guantanamo was taken from Cuba a century ago at gunpoint. They said, give us Guantanamo or else. Cuba was under military occupation. It's called a treaty, but, you know, okay. But, and the treaty of Guantanamo, if you want to call it that, allowed Guantanamo to be used as a coaling station for the Navy. Well, you know, it's not what it's being used for. In fact, as you know perfectly well, it was used for Haitian refugees. When Haitians were fleeing from the dictatorships that the U.S. was supporting, the U.S. refused to permit them political asylum. It claimed that they were just economic refugees. Yeah. And the Coast Guard tried to stop them, and if any got through, they sent them to Guantanamo. Yeah. Okay. And now you know what they're being used for. Actually, what they are being used for is to create terrorists. It's not my opinion. Now, that's the opinion of the main U.S. interrogators, people like Matthew Alexander, who actually has an article on it in the same issue of national interest that I mentioned. So yeah, it's a way, great way to create terrorists. It inspires terrorism all over, and it turns many of these people there into terrorists, even if they were picked up for whatever reason it was. So yes, if you want to, if your goal is to reduce the threat of, say, Islamic terrorism, and to become part of the civilized world, you have civilian trials. Just as the you know, those who are in Guantanamo, first of all, most of those who are in Guantanamo, I mean, it's kind of outrageous anyways. They're like some 15-year-old kid who was found holding a rifle when the U.S. is invading his country. That's a terrorist, you know. Okay, but that's a large part of maybe almost all of what's in Guantanamo. But if you want it, what should have been done with them if the goal was to be civilized and to reduce terrorism is to put them in prison in the United States. Well, there's no security problem. You know, they're not going to get out of a maximum security prison. And they don't have some magic way of spreading poison around the world or anything. But of course, the government didn't want to do that because they had no evidence. And if they were sent to Guantanamo so that they could, it was hoped, be free from U.S. Jurisdiction. So you could play that, you could pretend that they weren't under U.S. jurisdiction, so the laws didn't apply. Well, you know, the Supreme Court finally, after a long time, kind of whittled away at that and said, yes, they have the right of habeas corpus. The Bush administration accepted that. Obama doesn't. The Obama administration is trying to overturn a decision by a right-wing Bush judicial appointee that the Supreme Court decision holds for Bagram, the torture center in Afghanistan. And the Obama administration is trying to override that so that that means that the Supreme Court decision is just a joke. If you want to torture somebody, don't send them to Guantanamo because the Supreme Court said you can't torture them there. Send them to Bagram. So if you pick somebody up in Yemen or, you know, wherever you pick them up, and you want them to not to be subject to international law, also U.S. law, okay, send them to Bagram. That's the Obama administration position. I mean, it's for reasons like these that even the most hawkish terrorism specialists, people like Michael Scheuer, who was, you know, in charge for the CIA of following Obama for years, he says that Al-Qaeda's Osama bin Laden's best ally is the United States. You know, we're doing exactly what he wants. What he wants is trying to sell a line to the Muslim world. You know, these guys are on a crusade. They're trying to kill us. We've got to defend ourselves. And the U.S. is acting, you know, as if they're under command. You know, yeah, we do everything he wants.
What do you think Obama should do about Israel-Palestine? What do you think people here should do?
I mean, Israel-Palestine happens to be a particularly easy case. I mean, there has been an overwhelming international consensus for 35 years on how to settle the problem, short term at least, namely a two-state settlement on the international border, which everyone agrees on, with the phrase was minor and mutual modifications. That was U.S. official policy until the U.S. departed from the world in the early 70s, as it did. That's just overwhelming. I mean, there was a Security Council resolution in 1976 calling for a two-state settlement. The U.S. vetoed it. And it just goes on from there. I won't run through it. But if you get till today, it's just overwhelming agreement. I mean, it includes all the Arab states for a long time. It includes Iran, the Organization of Islamic States. It includes Hamas, you know. In fact, everybody except the United States and Israel. So what has Obama had to say about this? Well, it's interesting. He has this great vision. But if you go below the vision and take a look at the words, it's a little different. So his only words so far, there are two really. One is to politely ask Israel to stop expanding settlements. Well, first of all, that's meaningless. The issue is the existence, not the expansion of the settlements. But furthermore, those words were also meaningless. He was quoting Bush. In fact, he was quoting what's called the roadmap, the official, supposedly the agreed upon scenario for moving forward. He was quoting it. Okay, that's meaningless, but that's part of his great vision. The other part, which is more interesting, was a few days after he took office. And he gave his one and so far only a serious talk about Israel-Palestine. That's when he was introducing George Mitchell as his negotiator, which is a good choice if he's given any leeway. And Obama explained what he was going to do. He said this was his, you know, being very forthcoming to the Arab world. He said, well, there's a constructive proposal on the table, the Arab peace proposal, you know, pat people on the head for producing it. And then he went on to say, well, it's time for the Arabs to live up to their peace proposal. They should start normalizing relations with Israel. Well, you know, Obama's literate, intelligent. I suppose he chooses his words carefully. He knows perfectly well that that was not the Arab peace proposal. The Arab peace proposal re-endorsed the long-standing international consensus and said, in the context of a two-state settlement, the Arab states will proceed even beyond to normalize relations with Israel. Well, Obama picked out the corollary, but omitted the substance, which is a way of saying we're going to maintain our rejectionist stance. Couldn't have been clearer. And that's what's happened. With regard to his repetition of the call to stop expansion of settlements, he did go a little bit farther. Not he, but his spokespersons in press conferences. They were asked, is the administration going to do anything about it and if Israel rejects it? And they said, no, it's purely symbolic. In fact, explicitly said that the administration is not going to do what George Bush the first did, George Bush the First had some light taps on the wrist if Israel continued to reject what the U.S. was asking for. Clinton pretty much withdrew that, and Obama withdrew it totally. He said, no, this is just symbolic. Well, that's telling Benjamin Netanyahu, go ahead and do what you like. You know, we'll say we don't like it, but there'll be a wink saying, yeah, go ahead. Meanwhile, we participate in it. You know, we send you the arms, we give you the diplomatic support and the direct participation. That's the vision, you know. It could hardly be clearer. You know. Now, what can we do about it? Well, you know, we can get the United States to join the world. In this case, it's literally the whole world. Just accept, join the world and accept the international consensus and stop the direct participation in violating it. I mean, what Israel is doing, and it should, what the U.S. and Israel are doing, everything Israel does is a joint operation. They can't go beyond what the U.S. permits and participates in. So what the U.S. and Israel are doing in Gaza and in the West Bank is destroying the hope of for realization of the international consensus. And there's no alternative around, I should say, with regard to a lot of the supporters of the Palestinians. In fact, some of the leading Palestinian activists themselves are saying, well, we ought to give up on the two-state solution and just let Israel take over all the territories, maybe annex them, and then there'll be a civil rights struggle, and like an anti-apartheid struggle, and that can work, like South Africa. That's just blindness. That's not going to happen. The U.S. and Israel are not going to permit that to happen. They're going to continue with exactly what they're doing, strangling Gaza, separating it from the West Bank in violation of international agreements, and in the West Bank, take over whatever they want. So take over the arable land, you know, the nice suburbs of Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, which happen to be in the West Bank. Take over the Jordan Valley, arable land again, take over the water resources, and build this salience running through the rest of the territory that divide it, break it up into cantons. What Ariel Sharon, the author of the policies, the main author, was honest enough to call Bantustans. Well, let's break it up into that. It doesn't take any responsibility for the Palestinians, no demographic problem, no Arabs in a Jewish state, no anti-apartheid struggle, no civil rights struggle. And that's not hypothetical, that's just what we're doing. So yeah, we'll continue to do that. That's the alternative to a two-state settlement. And it's within reach, you know. Greater things than that have happened easily. But it's going to take a lot of pressure.
We're going to take some questions from the audience. You can see the microphone set up. And as people go for that microphone, one last question. As you look out on folks here, many young people, many students, I was wondering if you could reflect on your career at the moments when you had to make a decision about whether to take a risk that might risk your position or your standing in some way. When you felt what you say to people when it comes to issues of courage?
Well, you know, I don't like to talk about myself, and it's not important, but since you asked a couple of times. The first time, I mean, I had been a political activist all my life, you know, since childhood. I mean, you talked about my newsstand and so on. But with regard to, say, really doing something, say, becoming involved with the non-existent anti-war movement, the first time was around 1962. You could see what was happening in 1962. It wasn't really concealed. And I decided to try to get involved in organizing anti-war activism. Now, it wasn't risky, but it meant giving up a lot. You cannot put, I don't have to tell you, you can't put one toe in this. If you get into it, it's a full-time occupation.
Were you a tenured professor at the time? You, 1956, you went to MIT, you were teaching.
1955, I forget what year it was, but it wasn't a consideration. In fact, it may be odd for you to think about, but MIT in the 1960s had two interesting characteristics. One was almost entirely funded by the Pentagon. In fact, I was in a lab which was 100% funded by the three armed services. Two, it was the main center of anti-war resistance. I'm not talking about dissent or, you know, protest. I'm talking about resistance, you know, organizing resistance activities, illegal activities. And the Pentagon didn't care much because contrary to what a lot of people believe, one of the main functions of the Pentagon is just to provide a cover for the way the economy functions. The way the economy functions is, you know, people like to claim it's a free market economy, but, you know, most of it comes out of the state sector. I mean, computers, internet, airplanes, you know. The idea is the public is supposed to pay the costs and take the risks, and if anything works out, you hand it over to private enterprise. It's called the free market. And when the economy was mainly electronics-based, the Pentagon was the cover. So, you know, you got to do this because the Russians are coming. But they actually didn't really care what you were doing. I mean, it's an interesting story. Anyhow, so yeah, maybe I was tenured, maybe not, but it didn't matter. I got involved in 1962, and what that meant, so like if I'd give a talk in a church, which I sometimes did, it would mean four people, you know, the minister, the organizer, a drunk who walked in off the street, and a guy who wanted to kill me. That was a talk in a church. And that went on for a couple of years. The only really risky step...
Are you suggesting the anti-war movement during Vietnam was mainly alcoholic?
Right. Don't tell David Brooks. In 1965, I tried to organize... An artist friend of mine, since died, try to organize national tax resistance. Well, we got somewhere, so that's taking, you know, sort of a mild risk. But in 1966, there were the stirrings of an effort to organize more serious resistance.
Did you not pay your taxes?
I didn't pay my taxes for years. But how the IRS reacted is kind of interesting. And in my case, of course, they can get the money. You know.
And did they just take it out of your salary?
Took it. I got a nasty letter from them from some computer. But in some cases, they randomly, as far as I could tell, they took people's houses, people went to jail, and so on. So there's a kind of a risk associated with it. But more serious was support of direct resistance, support for resistors, deserters, and so on and so forth. And that began around 1966. It became public in 1967, and that did carry potential penalties. I mean, actually, my wife, we had three kids. She went back to college after 17 years because we expected I'd probably end up in jail. You know? And it came pretty close. I mean, a trial was announced in 68, which I was the main defendant. I was saved, as were others, by the Tet Offensive. The Tet Offensive came along in January 1968, and it convinced the business world in the United States that the U.S. that this was just becoming too costly.
What were you charged with?
The charges were conspiracy to, you know, resist the draft or overthrow the government or something or other. Now, the conspiracy trials are kind of an interesting story. I could talk about them, but it was real. You know, if it hadn't been for the Tet Offensive, I probably would have spent a couple of years in jail.
But did you go through the trial?
The trials were called off right after the Tet Offensive. There was one that was underway, but you know, the Spock trial, where they picked all the wrong people, and it was overturned on appeal, but mainly because of the Tet Offensive. I mean, the business world just said, look out. In fact, what happened in 1968 is that a group of so-called wise men, you know, big shots from Wall Street and so on, went down to Washington and basically gave the president marching orders. It was a very real power play. Johnson was told, stop the bombing of North Vietnam, don't run for office again, and begin negotiations and start to withdraw. And he followed orders to the letter. Then Nixon came along and did it a different way. But the visible escalation of the war declined. visible, I say, because some of the worst atrocities were in 1969, and then it went off to Cambodia and Laos, where it was even worse, but that was kind of invisible, still is. But it kind of tempered at that point, and one of the things that was done was to call off the trials, because there was an effort on the part of the government to sort of make peace, you know, make peace with the students, and that was an interesting story, too. But that ended the trials. But yeah, that was yeah, it was risky. Civil disobedience is—it's no fun, you know. I mean, you can't really say it's risky. So maybe you get maced or beaten or something like that. Spend a couple of days in jail, but not the pleasantest experience. But it's not the kind of risk that dissidents take in other countries, you know. But that's the kind of decisions you have to make. You just can't become involved part-time in these things. It's either serious and you're seriously involved, or you know, you go to a demonstration and go home and forget about it and go back to work. You know, nothing happens. You know. I mean, things only happen by really dedicated, diligent work. I mean, we're not allowed to say nice things about the Communist Party, right? That's like a rule. But one of the reasons why the New Deal legislation worked, you know, which was significant, you know, just changed the country, was because there were people who were there every day, whether it was a civil rights issue, a labor rights issue, organizing, anything else. They were there, ready to turn the mimeograph machines, no internet, organize demonstrations. They had a memory, you know, the movement had a memory, which it doesn't have now. Now everyone starts over from fresh. But it had a kind of a tradition, a memory that people were always there. If you look back, it was very heavily Communist Party activists. Well, you know, that was destroyed. And it's one of the lack of such a sector of dedicated, committed people who understand that you're not going to win tomorrow. You know, you're going to have a lot of defeats, and there'll be a lot of trouble, you know, and a lot of things will happen to you that aren't nice. But if you keep at it, you can get somewhere. That's why we have had a civil rights movement, and the labor movement, and so on.
Someone have the microphone?
Thank you very much, Professor Chomsky. I had the pleasure to listen to you when I was a graduate student many years ago, and I happened to be in town. I'm glad to listen to you here today. Some years back, before he died, Bob McNamara wrote a book, The Fog of War. Actually, it's a movie, and he also drew some lessons from the war. What is your assessment of the lessons of Vietnam? How effectively do you think we as a nation are applying them today, and what would you change based on that experience?
I'll tell you what I think and what I wrote back in 1970, which I still think, but I have to tell you, I'm like a minority of one, so it's no consensus opinion. The left doesn't like it, the right doesn't like it, nobody likes it. The only people who liked it, what I was saying then, was the business world, because I was basically repeating what they were saying. What they were saying around 1970, part of the reason for telling Johnson, you know, call it off, is they recognized that the U.S. had already won the war. I mean, the left doesn't like to hear that because they like to hear, you know, people united and can never be defeated and so on and so forth. Makes you feel good. Actually, the peace movement, the anti-war movement had an effect. I mean, it saved the society from total destruction, which probably would have happened. So it did have an effect. But the U.S. achieved its major war aims and had done so by around 1970. If you look back at the planning, we have a detailed record of internal planning from the Pentagon Papers and later releases. The goal of the war was not to conquer Vietnam. Vietnam's of no particular interest to the United States. It could, you know, fly off the face of the earth and the U.S. wouldn't have cared. Eisenhower tried to build up some support for the war by talking about the tin and the rubber and so on, but that was so marginal it didn't matter. What they were afraid of is what a very consistent feature of policy, right through U.S. policy, but you know, imperial policy generally. It's a policy that for the public is called the domino theory. and then when it doesn't work, you kind of laugh about it. But it's a real principle, so it never changes. And what you ought to call it is the mafia principle. International affairs is run like the mafia, very much like it. And the Godfather does not accept disobedience. It's too dangerous. You know, even if it's some small storekeeper somewhere who isn't paying protection money, you can't accept that. I mean, if he doesn't pay protection money and gets away with it, you know, the next guy will stop, start, and pretty soon the whole system control erodes. So what you do is you send in your goons, not just to get the money, which you don't care about, but to beat them to a pulp so everyone else gets the idea. You know, you don't disobey orders. That's the way international affairs runs, pretty much. Cuba is a case in point. Iran today is a case in point. And Vietnam was very clearly a case in point. The U.S. was concerned that Vietnam might move towards successful independent development, which could be what planners called a virus that would spread contagion. We don't care about Vietnam, but if the contagion spreads to Thailand and especially to Indonesia, which really had rich resources, that would be dangerous. Then the system of control starts to fall apart. And what they were really concerned about was what John Dower, a leading Asia historian, called the super domino. Super domino was Japan. If Indonesia and the rest of Southeast Asia began to move towards independent development, Japan would accommodate, was the word that was used. Japan would accommodate to an independent developing South and Southeast Asia and would become its technological center and its commercial center and so on. That would mean that the United States had lost the Second World War. It's not a small thing. The Second World War in the Pacific was fought in large measure to prevent Japan from establishing what it called a new order, approximately what I just described. Well, the United States in 1950 wasn't ready to lose the Second World War. And that was the main reason for supporting the French reconquest of the colony. And by the late 60s, it was evident that Vietnam is never going to be a model for anyone. It'll be lucky if it survives. And by 1965, the contagion had been stopped. You got a virus that's spreading contagion. What you do is destroy the virus and inoculate the targets. Well, that was done. You take a look at what was happening in the 60s. Brutal dictatorships were instituted in all the surrounding countries. Okay, that inoculates them. No virus. The virus was destroyed by the late 60s. In 1965, the most important country, Indonesia, there was a coup. Suharto coup killed maybe a million people, mostly landless peasants, destroyed the only mass political party. It was greeted with total euphoria in the United States, England, and Australia. I mean, they just couldn't contain themselves. You know, a gleam of light in Asia, New York Times, and so on. I mean, they knew it was happening. You know, staggering mass slaughter, a gleam of light in Asia, nothing secret. But it was recognized that, and they opened themselves up to Western exploitation, so it was all wonderful. In retrospect, McGeorge Bundy, who was the national security advisor for Kennedy and Johnson, in retrospect, he said he thought we really should have called off the war in Vietnam in 1965 because the main result, outcome, it had already basically been won after the Indonesian coup. And going on was just too costly for ourselves, so it was a dumb thing to do. Anyway, that was my feeling then, and it's pretty much my feeling now. The lesson that we ought to learn, there was a split in American public opinion, very sharp split, very visible in the early 70s, between elite opinion, you know, newspapers, Harvard faculty, and so on the one hand, and the general population on the other, not the anti-war movement, the general population. In elite opinion, articulate opinion, and that you can read, so it's easy to document, the most extreme condemnation of the war was that it was a mistake which proved to be too costly. Okay, that's about as far as you can go. Among the public, about 70% in polls said it's not a mistake, it's fundamentally wrong and immoral. Okay. It's a very sharp and significant split, and I think the lesson we'll learn is to bring it to today, that say when Obama is praised for opposing the war in Iraq because he thought it was a mistake, we should recognize that to be on a par with Nazi generals after Stalingrad, who thought that the two-front war was a mistake. The issue isn't whether it was a mistake, it's whether it's fundamentally wrong and immoral. Well, that's the lesson that has to be drawn. That's what the public probably already understands, but we have to do something with and organize with.
I'll just say one thing. There's this quote that I've been trying to find out who said it. I think back on my life over all the times I thought I went too far, and I realize now I didn't go far enough. I don't think Noam Chomsky said that.
Yeah, that's a good quote.
I think we will have to stop here. Professor Chomsky has other engagements, but I would really like to thank Professor Chomsky and Ms. Amy Goodman for joining us today.